Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. We have with us from the Western Heritage Center, Lauren Hunley, who is a community historian and also fairly new to the Billings community. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you.
And want to welcome Kevin Koistra to the studio as well. Kevin is the executive director of the Heritage Center. And Kevin, you've been at the helm for a good many years.
Less than 3 years.
Oh,
but
my goodness.
I've been at the museum for decades, honestly. So
that's why it feels like I've known you forever.
Kevin was the community historian at the Heritage Center. But before we get into what's going on, I mean, it's sort of exciting news that the center has been closed, it's reopened, there's new exhibits. I want to know more about the history of the Western Heritage Center. I am so old that I remember as a teenager being a volunteer at the Parmalee Billings Library at the front desk of what is now the Heritage Center. Can you tell us a little bit about when the Western Heritage Center became active after the library moved, and a little bit more about your organization?
During the 1960s, obviously, the library had a crisis of space, decided to move into a location, the old warehouse building on North Broadway. The building, the old Parmalee Billings Memorial Library, was abandoned, basically, by the city at the time. And there was some talk about tearing it down. The building next door was Shields Hardware at the time, and they needed some more parking. And basically, Vern Drake, who was an architect in town, got wind of the story that they wanted to demolish the old library. He had seen the courthouse torn down. The city hall had been torn down. And so it became his mission to save the old library building. So we opened in 1971, really largely due to a large group of volunteers and community members who kind of saw the need to create kind of a community center for Billings. Every once in a while, I hear about somebody who used the old library building, too. We'll actually get volunteers at the museum who used the library when they were younger as a place of refuge. So, like, if they had family issues or something in the 1950s or 60s, they always found the library was a place they could go. Years later, they'll come back to the Western Heritage Center to volunteer, like, at the front desk, because they have such a fond memory of the old library building. So
when it was a library, it was a museum. It was a
That's
place
right.
where archives and historical relics were stored. It's interesting that it now functions as an interpretive center, which is a mix of museum and library.
Yeah, all around town are remnants of that museum, too. The Yellowstone County Museum up in the hill has the old Josephine Bell. That came out of the original Billings Public Library Museum. We have some amazing Crow dolls and items. Chief Plenicoux's life mask that came from the original library museum, in a sense. MSU Billings here has the animal mounts, the stuffed animals over at the science building. Those actually used to be on display at the public library starting in like about the 1930s and 1940s. So a lot of those items are still out here in this community.
And the Heritage Center still has a really strong working relationship with the Billings Public Library in terms of their Montana room and archives. And so you share material back and forth?
Absolutely. Years ago, when the big transition to the new facility happened 5 to 7 years ago, we actually started working with the public library to assess their collections, begin scanning some of the amazing historic photographs they have, to look through the documents that were in those vertical files, amazing documents that were there, that were available. We scanned those, and they're available in the Montana Memory Project now. So, and we continue to have a relationship with, obviously, the library with programming. And I always thought Billings, it's like a curse and a blessing. Billings has always had growth and its economy. The best towns for preservation are ghost towns. But Billings, because of its continued growth through the 1950s, 60s, there were always movements to take out the old, bring in the new. And so even when you have commercial blocks, what happens is you'll tear out one building, then another. Like somebody said, you know, historic blocks are like a smile. And what happens when you don't have good preservation is it's like knocking teeth out of the smile. You know what I mean?
My home was almost turned into a parking lot, and it was Senior Hart, who was very involved with saving historic parts of Billings, that bought the home to prevent it from being torn down and got it on the National Historic Register.
Billings loves its parking lots and parking structures. They tried to tear down the Babcock to build a parking garage.
Yeah, that's true. We love our parking lots here.
Well, and Lauren, you're fairly new to the Billings community, but certainly not new to Montana. You have a love affair with the state that dates back to when you interned at the Little Bighorn Battlefield. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about what you've experienced since coming to the community and diving into its history and also looking perhaps at its future.
Billings has an incredible lot going on, and there's also the hope and expectation for that to continue to grow. Really understanding, and I've heard this from multiple civic leaders, understanding that there is a role that Billings can play moving forward. And in order to fulfill that role, Billings has to appeal to a certain generation now in order to invite them, not only invite them into the city, but to keep us here. Billings is a snapshot of Montana, of what we're doing and ways that we can grow.
I am interested, Lauren, in how do museums stay relevant? I know that you have done some major work in redoing the Heritage Center in terms of the exhibition space. How do we stay relevant to a new generation?
That's a question that the entire museum field internationally is struggling with. There are a lot of really great things happening across the country that museums are really starting to explore how to stay relevant and how to continue attracting new audiences. Recognizing that museums can be a social space, recognizing that museums, you know, forever and ever, we've always understood museums as educational spaces. You come in, you bring a field trip in, you take a weekend, you go in and you read the panels and you learn something new. What we're seeing today is younger families coming in and they're looking at it not necessarily to learn something new, but to learn something new about their group and about each other. Having these social experiences that if they learn a new fact, that's fantastic, but their primary goal is to interact with each other and to interact and create a new experience together. So some of the changes that we have done at the Western Heritage Center, and I have to give major props to Kevin because we started talking about some of these exhibits and I started asking if I could take out walls. And
I think initially I was stunned. and then Lauren looked for advocates in the museum itself, like Al Gearing, our maintenance guy. And Al's comment was, take those walls down? That's about time. So she got a lot of support.
I love the idea of taking down walls instead of putting up
Absolutely.
Walls.
Absolutely.
Shouldn't that be the mission of...
I feel like, you know, what we're seeing is in taking down walls, we open up spaces. And by opening up spaces, we provide more room for people to interact with each other and to interact with the exhibit itself. And we're also seeing, we as a museum employee or as a museum representative may have a specific idea of how people should go through our exhibit. We want you to start in this space and do this first. You have to learn this piece of information before you can move on and learn this piece of information. That's not how people are using exhibits anymore. People are going in and they're going to mold the exhibit to what they want. They're going to move through it the way they want to. They have their own expectations of what they're going to get out of this. So that doesn't always line up with what I have in my head and what I want. So by opening up these exhibits, we are allowing them to do what they want with the space in regards to movement, in regards to interaction with their group, with other visitors, and with the information that we have for them. So we have to take all of this into consideration when we design an exhibit and when we create information and putting it out there in accessible, swallowable tidbits.
Yeah, I was going to ask how this changes how you present information. Kevin, you've described this process as having to really synthesize information down to its most distilled. How has that changed how you present things, especially bringing on board Lauren, who has perhaps a different view on how to present information?
Well, it depends on your background, where you're from. I mean, really, you know, if you're an anthropologist or if you're a museum studies person or a historian, you approach exhibits differently. So, for example, Elizabeth de Grenier, who did a wonderful job as a community historian for a couple of years, was an incredible, astute historian. Volumes and volumes of material. And the difficult part in a museum is you have to recognize that people don't really read books standing up. So you have to take all of that information you learn, then start distilling it. And like I said before about Lauren, it's like she's very good at taking a lot of information, distilling it down into consumable bites. Sounds very exciting, you know, but...
sounds tasty.
Yeah, sounds tasty. You know, and that's really, you know, again, part of that experience. You don't want to overwhelm people. You know, we all have that experience when you walk into a museum and you see a text panel with 700 words in the first panel. It actually is a little disheartening. You know
I suppose
what I mean?
It's a bit inaccessible. And if you are trying to really tear down those walls, metaphorically and physically, that making museums more approachable to people through maybe perhaps a more socialized atmosphere, it sounds like a good approach.
I'm thinking of the show you had on the different cultures that existed on the South Side that
right.
people didn't know about, the history of baseball in Montana, which was very important. And then just last November, the World War I armistice.
Right.
I mean, I never think of World War I in Billings, and it was just so fascinating to hear how our community responded to World War I.
So, you know, you try to tie in to what's relevant in your community. You know, that makes it – that's really your job is really in that sense. But and the other thing, following up what Lauren said, so much of what we do now is outreach. Going into June, we actually reach a lot more people outside of the museum than we do coming into the museum. You know, whether it's public speaking, I mean, Lauren and I joke about this all the time. We're all on the speaker circuit for every senior center in town, but, you know, also, you know, traveling exhibits like at the airport or at the library. We're looking at ways that we can go out and reach, you know, a larger audience. You know, we can't expect everybody to come stumbling into the museum. It's just not reality. So even for this year, we have over 90 programs scheduled just for this 2019 season. Again, another way to bridge and get people excited about their history and things like that.
I want to circle back to this idea that museums are for everyone. And how do you attract a patron who might not necessarily feel like the museum's a place for them or the interpretive center?
Go ahead.
So I really feel like a large part of that is listening to our community. What kind of things are our community members doing? What are they interested in? Because if they're not already thinking of us, just putting a poster in front of their face may go, oh yeah, we should go down there sometime. And it doesn't make it into their Rolodex or their calendar or anything like that.
What's the amount that your programs have increased over last year? It sounds like you've definitely ramped up your time offerings.
In large part, yeah. The walking tours have steadily brought more and more folks. And we've added more programs, too. You know, even our speaker programs, the high noon lectures, we now film those. So we make them accessible in different formats, too. You know, we go to senior centers, we go to the schools to do the programs and stuff like that. But, you know, following up kind of what Lauren was saying, we recognize even in our own collections how, you know, we didn't have very much about the south side of Billings. We always say if we have 1,000 photographs in our collections, 950 were north of the tracks. So we looked at that as a challenge. How do we go out, find those stories of the Germans from Russia who were the first wave of immigrants with the sugar beets? The Hispanic populations during the 1920s, the African-American community, the Chinese, the Japanese, all on the South Side, incredible stories that have not been told. And then once we went to the South Side and said, you know, we're interested, it's amazing the volume of materials that have come our way to provide us the ability to build a traveling exhibit, working with Healthy by Design. And I know that Lauren, like, for example, has great stories about some of the folks she worked with on the South Side.
Well, I was just going to add that it really illustrates that we have to be proactive in understanding our limitations and being willing to take steps to adjust those and to make ourselves as accessible and out with our community as we can. We can't sit back and wait. We have to go out and interact with our community before they could even expect to interact with us.
I like the idea of being proactive, and I've always admired the Heritage Center for being inclusive of Native American culture, artists, and history. Certainly the Crow and Cheyenne projects that you did, recording histories, oral histories, an incredible archive. Is that a part of your mission?
Absolutely. I mean, we have this great responsibility to tell the stories of the people of this region. You know, it doesn't matter, really. Your ethnic identity is obviously critical, but really we want to reach out and find those stories. This is all part of this region's story, and we're privileged at times, like you mentioned, the American Indian Tribal Histories Project, which enabled the museum to hire a lot of Native American staff at the time to do interviews, to be part of our regular, in a sense, collection, all of those voices, all of those interviews, which Lauren just used for the art and adaptation exhibit that's up right now. You know, so she had the opportunity to go back and look at 90 videotaped interviews with Crow, not just elders, but artists and historians and stuff. So the material is there, and now it's 8 to 10 years old, but it's still there. That's part of our responsibility, to hold on to these stories so generations can have access to them too. So
one of the things that really attracted me to the Western Heritage Center when I first moved here was the fact that the Heritage Center has always, as Corby said, done a phenomenal job of providing space for people to tell their own story. So many times a museum will step out and say, this is what you did, or this is why what you did was important. They're not only speaking for you, they're deciding how your story fits into a larger narrative. The Western Heritage Center works really hard not to do that. Instead, we provide a space and we provide the resources within a way to work within a museum or an exhibit model, but to allow your voice to stand on its own. And we try really hard, not just with Native voices, but with immigrant voices, with civic leaders, with students, to have not only your story have a place, but to have its own power within your community and within what your experience is.
People ask us what we do, and it's almost corny, but it's very much my belief system. When people ask us what we do, we make people feel more at home. That's what our job is. So if you're a traveler to Billings, you can come to the Western Heritage Center, take a walking tour, come to our exhibits, maybe learn a little more about this place and feel a little more relaxed in some ways. And it's true for the people who lived here their whole lives. We hope that we can represent the stories with accuracy, with truth, but also that opportunity to make people feel more at home.
Not only making people feel at home, but empowering them and realizing that their stories are worth telling.
That's right.
I mean, that's what I saw with the stories of the South Side and that opening, and how many different racial and ethnic communities were there, so proud to see their history on the walls.
Yeah, we had people coming in for the reception, and of course it was a public reception, open, free, and we still had people from the South Side saying, where can I put some money? You know, that's not our intent. Our intent is to get people excited, but to have residents from the South Side be thrilled that part of their story is told. And actually, even the South Siders exhibit, which was at the airport for a couple months, is now at Orchard School.
I was going to ask. I just walked by that exhibit at Orchard, and it was a very refreshing to see these historic images alongside, the grade school Lego wall and the kids' portraits.
Tell us a little bit about what your current exhibits. You've been closed for a couple months. You've knocked the walls down. What can people expect to see when they go into the Heritage Center this spring?
So we recently reopened with four new exhibits. The first, Please Don't Feed the Bears, Close Encounters with Yellowstone Wildlife, will be up through the entirety of 2019 through December. And it's looking at the changing relationship between visitors and wildlife at Yellowstone National Park. That relationship has had massive changes over the last decade. Not decade, century. Excuse me. Add another zero in there. We have an exhibit on the Charles Barstow ledger art. So those pieces are currently on loan to us from MSU Billings.
Yeah, you have 22 of, I think it's a collection of over 60, of I think the largest of what ledger art dating back to the late 1800s.
Yeah, it's to me one of the most important collections that's here in Billings. Of course, MSU Billings has done a wonderful job, especially in the special collections and library, taking care of that collection, making sure it was properly archivally mounted and things like that. So it has traveled quite a bit because of that. But yeah, we're very privileged to share these ledger drawings, and what they are basically like people like Chief Medicine Crow, Plenty Coups, major leaders of the Crow, were asked by this Charles Barstow, a clerk, in the 1880s to draw pictures of what they experienced, tell the story of a certain battle, tell a story about Crow courtship. When they went to Washington, D.C. in 1880 as part of the delegation of Crows that went to the look at leasing lands and things like that, they came back from their experience of going to the zoo at Washington. And Medicine Crow actually draws the pictures of the animals that he saw at the zoo in Washington. They're just an amazing set of drawings.
I knew about that collection for a long time, and until I saw it, I didn't get what ledger meant.
Right.
That is amazing. They didn't have drawing pads. These were big line pads, literally ledger pads, that they, you know, annotated with these stories, both historic and contemporary.
Yeah, like you would see, like, for your accounting, you know, in an old business, that type of thing, you know what I mean? So, yeah, they're just a wonderful gift, you know. And then Lauren has done a great job working with Amberly Whiteman and Mardell Plainfeather and, like I said, the interviews with the American Tribal Histories Project to put together art and adaptation.
So art and adaptation is looking at the transforming art of the Epsilaga. We used consciously Epsilaga versus Crow because the art and adaptation exhibit is told from the Crow perspective. And of course, Epsilaga is what the Crow call themselves. It's looking at changing artistic methods, processes, artists, very heavily influenced and contains a lot of information from contemporary artists, including Kevin Redstar, Jared Stewart, Luella Johnson, lots of Crow elders. There's some information from Dr. Medicine Crow in there as well, including historic objects as well as contemporary pieces and even expanding into the realm of performance art. It's been a really fun project to put together.
We both are really excited about the materials we have on loan from Chief Plenty Coups State Park. The park has had these paintings by Buster Bellrock, who I know really nothing about except that he was an artist, a Crow artist in the 1930s. And I don't know how much more you could share.
So Chief Plenty Coups State Park has been phenomenal in giving us access to their collection. And the pieces, most of the pieces that they've loaned to us for this exhibit have never before been on display. We have a leather jacket that was owned by Chief Plenty Coups. We have several pieces from his wives. And then, of course, the Buster Bellrock paintings that Buster Bellrock, was the grandson of Chief Medicine Crow. Chief Medicine Crow actually bestowed on him the chieftainship, which was a really unique and really rare process, and was a phenomenal artist, was really starting to gain exposure as an artist before Native art was a thing even, and unfortunately died tragically young. And so we have multiple paintings of his that are on display. His collection is on display as part of this exhibit.
And downstairs in the community gallery, you've also brought an artist to the table who is really young, Judd Thompson. He's also represented by the Stapleton Gallery, and he has shown his work with other contemporaries.
I guess that means that history doesn't stop, does it?
No, absolutely not.
I knew Judd Thompson when he was a little boy out at the trading post, terrorizing any of the tourists that came through the door. I mean, he was just a wild, charming little kid. But he grew up a white boy in Crow Country. And I think his work is so fascinating and beautiful. I'm interested, how do you bring that contemporary artist into a historical museum?
Well, and one of the things that we really understand with Judd, too, is that his father was adopted by the Real Bird family. So in a lot of cultural ways, Judd was completely surrounded by Crow culture and participated in that. And he uses that as a very specific contemporary lens on historic, well-known Crow imagery. And that's what he uses as the basis of a lot of his art. And for us, it's really exciting because again, looking at voices and whose voice matters and empowering voices and empowering our visitors as they come to our space, we're not just giving them the historian's viewpoint. We're not just putting a quote on a panel in front of them and making them draw their own conclusions. We're also providing a perspective of somebody who's been completely surrounded by a culture and is now using a completely different way to express that through color and paint and photography. So for me, there's no separation between history museum and contemporary, whether it's contemporary art or photography or contemporary craftsmanship, because it's a continuous flow. It blends into and out of each other. And I think it really gives us a great opportunity to continue to be a welcoming space for audience members, for our visitors.
There is a lot going on at the Western Heritage Center. I am so delighted to have the two of you in here. Kevin, I think she's a good addition to your staff.
She is. This is today her six-month review, and she has passed with flying colors. I want to say on air that she just got a raise today.
Excellent. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome so very
much. So good to hear.
So, Lauren, it's so good to have you in the community.
Thank you very much. I'm really excited. I'm really loving it so far.
And Kevin, thank you for all of your energy for Billings and your historic knowledge. You are an enthusiastic historian, and it's always great to visit with you.
My pleasure.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.